So for short distance communications up to 25 miles, the VHF and UHF bands are very reliable, which obviously this repeater here is pretty reliable. It's getting out into the horizon, out to the horizon for quite a few miles. We're not reaching right now, we're not reaching another state, we're not getting into Pennsylvania. As far as the horizon is concerned, because the antenna's up so high, you know, I can look out, and because I was at the antenna last week, I can look out and I can see New Jersey. So we're getting into New Jersey, I can see Connecticut, I can see Long Island Sound, and so on. But past that, you know, any further north than that, than what we can see, most of the time, they're not going to hear us. So again, for short distance communications up to 25 miles, the VHF and UHF bands are very reliable. Interference levels and static are low, and fading is rare. Fading does occur at times at the extreme ends of the transmitted range. It is often the result of variations in the amount of atmospheric bending due to changes in weather conditions. So there you go. There's your atmosphere and your weather conditions, affecting at the very end of your the range that we're transmitting. Sunspot activity also influences VHF propagation at the low frequency end of the band. Now, I was talking earlier about the different layers in earlier discussions. So it says here, the F layer becomes so dense that it refracts the lower frequency television signals back to Earth. And they're referring to TV signals. You know, TV being on the low end of the VHF band. As I said, channel 2 is 50 megs or so. So this type of propagation is very rare and usually occurs only during the maximum of the sunspot cycle. During any part of the sunspot cycle, sporadic E propagation can give long distance television transmission by far the most common type of long distance television and FM transmission is caused by unusual amount of tropospheric bending. Okay, I'm on 5 after 9. I'm right on schedule here because I only have one more paragraph to go without bending too many people's ears. The range of transmission in the UHF band is not as great as for VHF. The higher frequency of the UHF band means that the signal is more like a light beam. See, the rule of thumb is the higher the frequency we go, the more it acts as light and goes more in a straight line. And, you get into the gigacycle range, you get into waveguides and so on, and, how the signal transverses through a waveguide, which is another discussion right there. It basically travels, in a straight line. The wavelength is very short. And there's different modes that it travels. Just to mention that. We can get into that microwave discussion later on. But I just thought I'd mention it. So, atmospheric bending is less, and therefore the UHF wave does not follow the curvature of the Earth as readily as the VHF wave. At the same time, the UHF signal strength decreases more rapidly as it travels through the atmosphere. What I've noticed also, and just for information, is that if you're operating on UHF during the summertime as opposed to in the wintertime, the big difference is, or one of the differences, is no leaves on the trees. And those leaves attenuate the signal. We call them little green attenuators. I've had the pleasure of operating on amateur TV, ATV band, many years ago, and I've actually noticed that condition. between the time that the leaves are on the trees as opposed to the times of leaves are off the trees, and that's because of the water droplets that the leaves hold, which affect the signal strength, the attenuation, and so on. All right. The UHF wave is more readily reflected from obstacles and is less able to fill in behind a large obstacle than in the VHF range. And they show here a hill as an example. So if you have a hill in the way, it's on UHF, it's more readily reflected from that hill and is less able to fill it behind the hill because it's reflected from the hill. You're gonna have less of a signal on this is on UHF band as opposed to VHF. So if you have a hill that's in the way, trying to get that signal on the other side of the hill will be a little bit more difficult unless you're running more power. So in the figure that they're showing, the obstacle is a hill. Notice that the VHF signal is able to fill in a little behind the hill, while the more concentrated UHF beam does not dip down as much, but continues on a nearly straight line path beyond the hill. So again, visualizing this, your UHF signal is not going to bend downward behind the hill to fill in the hole, so to speak, as much as a VHF signal. So that UHF signal is going to keep going straight past the hill. So you're going to have like an area where your signal is going to be much weaker. The strong signal and weak signal areas are more pronounced in the UHF band than in the VHF band, as I just described. Therefore, it is possible to find dead spots even in the primary area of a UHF station, which do not exist for the VHF stations in the area. So, like I just said, in VHF, it'll be more filling up an area, filling up a hole, as opposed to UHF. And that's because of the UHF propagation. So they show a picture of a hill, and they show two waves, one on a UHF band, one on a VHF band, and they show how VHF will bend slightly down behind the hill, filling up the area behind the hill, and the UHF will just keep going straight. So that's basically it for now. I gave you a little bite-sized information on propagation of UHF, VHF. So in the preceding sections, we have discussed how a radio wave is propagated and how the factors that influence the radio wave transmission from the transmitting antenna to the receiving antenna. And we also discussed the radio frequency spectrum and the characteristics of the various frequency bands. Okay, so now the next step is how we're going to be discussing how antennas work. So I'll be going into the discussion of antenna fundamentals, and I'll wait till next week and we'll talk about that. So that's where we'll get into the different types of antennas and the fundamentals of them. So with that, it's 10 after 9. This is good because I do have to get outside and take care of some snow issues. And that's it. So Mike and Wayne and everyone else, I'll speak to you about the other things that's going on. Roy, thanks for the little dissertation today. I am listening to myself, and of course most people are hearing me because I'm hearing myself without too much interference and breakup that we had. So the change that we made at the repeater site did help. Not perfect, but it's better. Thanks a lot, Roy. See you next week. Talk to you on the next Andy's Quarter. AC2GS, W8CDL.
Thank you, Andy, once again for your presentation. I look forward to next Sunday's as well. And Once again, and this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This continues to be the Limar Technical Nest. If anyone has any further radio-related technical questions at this time, please give me your first name and your call sign.
NY2H.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Lou, what's your question or topic tonight?
All right, I'm coming in on Plainview, doing a test here. But I do have a question on the availability for the average Joe if he gets COVID. Are monoclonal antibodies available to him?
My understanding is that there are some degree of stockpiled supplies available. They are not available over the entire country. There are some supplies more in one area than another, and I've heard a few virologists and infectious disease and epidemiologists advise people that if they are in a high-risk group and have been diagnosed as having COVID-19, to ask their physician if such monoclonal antibodies are available. So, as far as I'm aware, they're still in stock, but I don't know exactly how much of that stock is available. But there is some. So people should kind of think about that if, God forbid, they get diagnosed and they meet any of the high-risk criteria.
Yeah, so I just had my blood work done a couple weeks ago. You know, not related to COVID, just scheduled. But I did ask the doctor about availability, and he really wasn't too sure, and he's my primary. So I don't know if I would have to go doctor shopping should I get into such a situation. Anyway, I think it's important also to indicate, if I'm correct on this, that that monoclonal antibody would be advisable only at the beginning stages, right? If you get into respiratory distress, then it's a whole different ball game. And you want to suppress the immune system. Is that right?
Yes, Lou, you're right. It's something to keep in mind early in the course of the treatment. My guess would be if you have a good relationship with your doctor, it's only a matter of him contacting the local health agencies and finding if a supply is available and arranging for a delivery and use. I don't know if you have to particularly shop for a doctor for that. It's just a matter of making them a little bit more aware of the availability, or at least at this point in time, availability of the monoclonal antibodies.
All right, very good. And I understand it's an IV, so, you know, whatever. All right, Roy, very good. It sounds good tonight, so we're getting better. So, thank you. NY2H.
The US2N?
Yes, Paul.
An interview with the head of this whole operation that Biden put in charge. I forgot the doctor's name, but he's in charge of the whole thing now. In the interview, he said if you go in, ask for it. He says there's plenty of it in stock right now. So he says, but you do have to ask for it. Tell your doctor you want it. So that's the deal. Back to you.
Well, I mean, the problem is distribution is not very good in general. So I have heard that the supplies are generally available. Maybe I'm just a pessimist. I assume that it is not a perfect distribution, so there are some areas that have been distributed more than others. And I would hope that a family physician who has a patient diagnosed doesn't really need to be reminded of a treatment suggestion. But, you know, caveat emptor, I guess, let the patient beware. So certainly, yeah. If you can conceive of yourself as being in the higher risk group and you test positive, then you should ask your family physician, and he should be able to hunt it down, at least at this point. I do not know what the stockpiles ultimately are. I don't know how many dosages are available. It might come a time when they're not as readily available as they right now seem to be. So I would agree with all of the people that remind your doctor. As far as I'm aware, it's available. It's gettable. You just have to be aware of it. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Tactical Net. I pretty much open things up for any discussion of any scientific concept you wanna bring up, and if I can elucidate or make any comments, hopefully that'll be good. So if anyone has any questions of any science or technology, now's as good a time as any. Hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. This includes medicine as well, but not personal medical problems, because that should be done by your family physician who's examined you and has a good history on you. Okay, try one more time. If anyone has any questions of technical or scientific nature, this is a good time as any. Otherwise, if there's nothing going on, we'll just bring back the good old science talk. I always have some articles of interest available. So if you have any questions, now's a good time. Okay, I take that as a vote for bringing back the science talk segment. Our first article tonight, as it used to be, started almost every one for the last year, is on the COVID-19 virus and its vaccine. The end of the week has brought along a flurry of encouraging news on the second wave of COVID-19 vaccines being tested in trials around the world. A recent clinical trials results from companies Johnson & Johnson and Novavax suggest that both their experimental vaccines are highly effective at preventing serious illness and hospitalization while still being well tolerated. Yet the findings also suggest that they're less effective against the variant of coronavirus that's become widespread in South Africa and is spreading elsewhere. Meanwhile, another vaccine, Oxford University and AstraZeneca's candidate, was just granted emergency use approval in the European Union. On Thursday, Novavax announced the results from its trials in UK and South Africa. The Phase 3 trial results in the UK indicate that the candidate is about 89% effective at preventing symptoms from coronavirus infection. Importantly, the trial took place during a time when a new variant in the country, dubbed B.1.1.7, was just starting to circulate widely. Despite B.1.1.7 being noticeably more transmissible and possibly deadlier, Novavax reported that its vaccine seemed to be nearly as effective at preventing illness from that variant as the other circulating strains, with a 95% effectiveness versus 85%. Let me drop for a sec. The company also presented data from a Phase 2B trial in South Africa, where the more transmissible variant, B.1.351, has been spreading widely. The vaccine was deemed to be 60% effective at preventing any illness from the virus in HIV-negative people. Across both HIV-positive and HIV-negative volunteers, the efficacy was said to be 49%. And when they studied COVID-19-positive cases more closely, nearly all of those identified were caused by B.1.351. On Friday morning, Johnson & Johnson announced the results from preliminary trial data of its candidate, which is being tested out as a single-shot treatment. Currently, approved COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. require two shots a month apart, approximately. Overall, it was shown to be 66% effective overall in preventing moderate to severe illness from the vaccine, but there were varying levels of effectiveness in different parts of the world. In the U.S., the effectiveness was 72%, but in South Africa, it dropped to 57%, which is likely due to the prevalence of the B.1.351 variant in the country. These trials results for Novavax and JJ aren't quite as rosy as they were for Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna's vaccine, which were the first two to win approval in the U.S. and Europe late last year, and are both based on similar messenger RNA technology. Both have shown around 95% effectiveness against the illness, though this data was obtained before the emergence of the new variants. But even if these second-wave vaccines are less effective, that doesn't mean they wouldn't be valuable tools in fighting off the pandemic. Let me drop for a sec. Both the Novavax and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines can be stored in standard refrigerator temperatures between 36 degrees and 46 degrees Fahrenheit, unlike the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, which require extremely cold temperatures. Moderna's vaccine can be kept in a refrigerator for up to 30 days, but it is still highly sensitive to lighting and temperature changes once taken out. Both of the newer vaccines are also expected to be cheaper than the messenger RNA vaccines, which will likely be a crucial factor for the lower-income countries that are facing hurdles in securing enough vaccines for their residents. Johnson & Johnson vaccine being a single shot would allow for smoother distribution as well. That said, there are trials of two-dose formulations ongoing, which could show that a booster shot will improve its effectiveness. Perhaps most importantly, though, is that these vaccines are likely still highly effective at preventing severe illness and death from COVID-19, even from the new virus variants. Novavax results found no severe cases among vaccinated people who developed the illness, and Johnson & Johnson candidate was found to be 85% effective overall at preventing severe illness, while no virus-related hospitalizations and deaths were found in the vaccinated group 28 days after treatment. A vaccine that protects more than half of everyone from illness and nearly everyone from serious complications is still one that would help turn the tide of the pandemic, even if the messenger RNA vaccines didn't exist. Countries in Europe are already facing the prospect of shortages of the existing Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, so any additional approved candidate would help. Let me drop. That need is likely one reason why the European Union has just Friday, approved the emergency use of another vaccine, one developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca. Their two-dose vaccine has shown to be around 60% effective at preventing illness overall. There's some mixed data has shown it to be more effective under different dosaging regimens, but that's still somewhat uncertain. Of all the vaccines reaching the end of development, Oxford AstraZeneca's candidate is thought to be the cheapest to produce. The vaccine was previously approved in the United Kingdom late last December, along with Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines. Novavax has already submitted an emergency use authorization in the United Kingdom and is expected to file for one in the United States as well. So likely not until its 30,000-person trial in the United States and Mexico is concluded. Johnson & Johnson is expected to submit its vaccine for an emergency use authorization in the United States in early February, and a decision may arrive within 2 weeks. according to Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Oxford AstraZeneca version may not be submitted for authorization in the United States until the spring, with a large-scale trial in the U.S. still ongoing. In any case, it's likely that several more COVID-19 vaccines will be available to the world in the months to come. In the meantime, continuing to take precautions like wearing masks and avoiding large indoor gatherings will be crucial to saving lives and reducing strain on the present healthcare system. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no comments. On to our next little story, also about coronavirus, but I promise you this will be the last in the series for tonight. Researchers in Ohio say that they've discovered two variants of the coronavirus local to the United States that may be of concern. One variant appears to contain a mutation found in other troubling variants, while the other has started to spread fast in Columbus, Ohio, over the last month and carries its own unique mix of mutation. The scientists believe that the Columbus variant is likely more contagious than past existing strains, though they caution little is still known about it. The variants were found by the researchers at The Ohio State University. Since March 2020, OSU's Wexner Medical Center has been mapping the genome of coronavirus strains collected from COVID-19 patients in the area. Viruses often mutate, and usually these mutations do not change how disease-causing viruses spread or infect their human host. But the researchers say they've come across two variants that could be trouble. One variant so far, only found in a single patient, carries a key mutation that is also found in the B.1.1.7 variant, first spotted in the United Kingdom last September. B.1.1.7 has rapidly spread throughout the United Kingdom since December and is strongly believed to be transmissible, more transmissible than earlier variants. The researchers believe that the mutation independently showed up in the United States variant from strains of virus circulating in the area already. Because the variant has only been seen in a single case, it's not known if and how common it is in the general population. The second variant may be even more worrying. From late December to January, OSU researchers have seen it pop up more often in their samplings from patients in Columbus, Ohio, to the point where it is now the dominant variant detected in new cases. That suggests that it's outcompeting other local strains. The Columbus variant is also unique to the United States, the researchers say, and carries a combination of three mutations on spike protein, not previously documented before. These mutations are likely making the variant more contagious, they suspect. Let me drop. The OSU team cautions that much is unknown about either variant, and though they plan to publish their preliminary findings in the preprint website, BioRxiv, soon, their data for now has not been seen and evaluated by outside scientists. Even these findings are as real as they appear. It will take time to understand the potential added risks of the new variants, that the new variants could pose. Quote, it's important that we don't overreact to the new variant until we obtain additional data, end quote, said Peter Moeller, a co-author of the upcoming paper and chief scientific officer at Wexner Medical Center, in a statement released by the OSU. Quote, we need to understand the impact of mutations on transmissions of the virus, the prevalence of the strain in the population, and whether it has more significant impact on human health, end quote. As with other variants seen recently, the OSU researchers do not suspect right now that these Ohio variants would greatly impact the effectiveness of existing vaccines and treatments in development. So far, no variant has been found to be more likely to cause serious illness or death, though their added transmissibility will likely lead to more cases, more hospitalizations, and possibly more deaths in the area where they become established. If nothing else, though, these latest discoveries highlight the danger of a widely spreading pandemic. The more cases of COVID-19 there are in an area, the more likely that concerning mutations could emerge and quickly spread in turn. where the country is still experiencing incredibly high levels of new cases, the possibility that things could get even worse than they are now is still very real. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no one's in a talkative mood tonight. On to another subject entirely that we've touched upon in the past. Scientists stunned the world last year by claiming to have discovered traces of phosphine in the Venusian clouds. New research suggests that this gas, which excitingly is produced by microbes, was not actually responsible for the signal they detected. Instead, it was likely sulfur dioxide, a really not too thrilling chemical. Extraordinary research published in Nature last September is being challenged by a paper set to be published in the Astrophysical Journal, a preprint of which is currently available at RXIV. This is not the first paper to critique the apparent discovery of phosphine on Venus, and is probably not going to be the last. That phosphine might be present on Venus was a revelation that blew some people's minds, and that's because living organisms are the only known sources of this gas. The team responsible for the apparent discovery, led by astronomer Jane Greaves from Cardiff University, found evidence in spectral signals collected by two radio dishes, the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope and the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. Spectral lines at a certain wavelength indicate the presence of specific chemicals, and in the case they implied the presence of phosphine in the Venusian cloud layer. The authors of the Nature study were not claiming that life exists on Venus. Rather, they were asking the scientific community to explain their rather bizarre observations. Indeed, it was an exceptional claim, as it implied that Venus, one of the most inhospitable planets of the solar system, might actually be hospitable with microscopic organisms floating through the clouds. Unfortunately, this doesn't seem to be the case. Let me drop for a second. Instead of phosphine in the clouds of Venus, the data are consistent with an alternative hypothesis. They were detecting sulfur dioxide. Victoria Meadows, a co-author of the new study and an astronomy professor at the University of Washington, explained in a statement, "Sulfur dioxide is the third most common chemical compound in Venus's atmosphere, and it is not considered a sign of life." Meadows, along with researchers from NASA, the Georgia Institute of Technology, and the University of California, Riverside, reached this conclusion by modeling conditions inside the Venusian atmosphere, which they did to reinterpret the radio data gathered by the original team. Quote, "This is what is known as a radiative transfer model, and it incorporates data from several decades' worth of observations of Venus from multiple sources, including observations here on Earth and spacecraft missions like Venus Express," explained Andrew Linkowski, a researcher with the UW Department of Astronomy and the lead author of the paper, in this statement. Equipped with the model, the researchers simulated spectral lines produced by phosphine and sulfur at multiple atmospheric altitudes on Venus, as well as how these signatures were received by ALMA and JCMC. Results show that the shape of the signal detected at 266.94 gigahertz likely came from Venusian mesosphere, an extreme height where sulfur dioxide can exist, but phosphine cannot owing to the harsh conditions there, according to research. In fact, so extreme is the environment that phosphine wouldn't last for more than a few seconds. Let me drop for a second. As the authors argue, the original researchers understated the amount of sulfur dioxide in the Venusian atmosphere and instead contributed the 266.94 gigahertz signal to phosphine. Both phosphine and sulfur dioxide absorb radio waves around this frequency. This happened, according to researchers, due to the undesirable side effect known as spectral line dilution. Study co-author and NASA JPL scientist Alex Atkins explained in his statement, "They inferred a low detection of sulfur dioxide because of an artificially weak signal from ALMA," added Linkowski. But in our modeling suggested that the line diluted ALMA data would have still been consistent with typical or even large amounts of venous sulfur dioxide, which could fully explain the observed JCMT signal. This new result could prove devastating to the Nature paper, and it will be interesting to hear how the authors respond to the latest critique. That said, some scientists believe the writing is already on the wall, or more accurately, in the trash bin. Let me drop for a sec. Already quickly after publication of the original work, we and others have put strong doubts on their analysis, wrote Ignaz Snellen, a professor at Leiden University. Now, I personally think that this is the final nail in the coffin of the phosphine hypothesis. Of course, one can never prove that Venus is completely phosphine-free, but at least there is now no remaining evidence to suggest otherwise. I am sure that others will keep on looking, though. Back in December, Snellen and his colleagues challenged the Nature study, arguing that the method used by Greaves' team resulted in a spurious high signal-to-noise ratio and that no statistical evidence existed for phosphine on Venus. The apparent absence of phosphine on Venus, and thus the absence of any hint of microbial life, is far less interesting than the opposite, but that's how it goes sometimes. Science makes no claims or promises about interesting things, and we, as the defenders of the scientific method, must come to accept our unfolding universe as we ultimately find it. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I don't think they're going to stop looking. You know, that whole theory was started, I remember, with Carl Sagan in one of his books. Many decades ago, probably in the 80s. And, you know, his theory was that Venus had to have life at one time. And of course, now nothing's left, and something should have survived in the atmosphere, you know, 30 miles up or so. It's actually a long-term plan into the future. It's not funded, but NASA would love to put send a satellite there and have a balloon open up with all kinds of instruments and have this thing float around, you know, from one end of Venus to the other. You just get it into the atmosphere and let it float as long as it can, round and around, and really search for something, not necessarily phosphine, but maybe something else. And you know, that theory I don't think is dead. I think, like what you said, people aren't going to stop looking. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, I am always for more experimentation, more observation, never less. So I agree with the article. I agree with you. People will keep on looking. The finding of phosphine was a little bit premature, in my very humble opinion, because of the similarity of detection of sulfur dioxide, which is all over the darn place on that planet. So it'll be interesting, and who knows, we may yet have a few more articles of further investigations on this theory, phosphine. And, you know, there are other molecules that might be found in the future, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss them as well.
Okay, I remember when the story first came out, recent story, that you brought up the point that they found this gas in the atmosphere of Jupiter, which is really a long shot to have life there. So, you know, right away that kind of started to put the nail in the coffin. Sounds like your report really finished that gas off anyway. I'd like to see them. I mean, the engineers anyway would love to send a satellite there and have some kind of floating balloon and, you know, 30 miles up. And, you know, if they don't find that, they could do plenty of research with something like that. But, I don't know. It'll be good. It looks like Russia sent many spacecraft there. They even landed there. But it would be nice to see NASA do more work. We had Magellan there doing the radar work for a couple of years. They mapped the whole planet. I'd like to go back there. Back to you.
And I think eventually we will. It's far easier to investigate our solar system than to go beyond it. Because beyond it is really, really far away. So we'll probably be keeping most of our detection equipment within the solar system, and so we'll visit that planet again. This is probably not the last paper. It's probably not going to be any particularly enthusiastic papers for the time being until they do some other studies that find something else. I think they've kind of knocked phosphine down for the count this time, but who knows? Things happen, times change, and we'll see what develops.
Just hope there's not too much of a lag time. You know, when the two Viking landers went to Mars in, 1977, and they didn't find anything. That's it. They didn't do anything for another 20 years. It took them 20 years to send Sojourner and the Pathfinder mission. And that was a big lag time. And now look, they really suspect there might still be something there, or some evidence of past life that they, you know, countless missions have been going to Mars ever since Sojourner and Pathfinder. And I hope you don't have a dry period of time like you did with Mars at Venus. But we'll see. There'll be plenty of missions to keep us busy. Back to you, Roger.
Yeah, it's difficult to predict, because you basically have to predict those people in Congress. Sometimes they're in the mood, sometimes they're not in the mood. Especially in the last year or so that we've developed trillions of dollars of debt, I sort of expected the Congress to be really tight-fisted with research and, money into anything but direct economic, manipulation and strengthening. But so far, I haven't heard anything to that effect. So, NASA might not get a financial crunch, even despite the looming debt.
I agree. And the percentage that they eat up is relatively small compared to the some of these other budgets that are going on. It's just that they're out there. They're noticeable. You know, something happens with NASA, either good or bad. It makes the news, and people say, oh, look at all the money that's going to NASA. So they always get picked on. What are you going to do?
Yeah, that's the downside of publicity. I mean, in addition to all that, I'm wondering, I'm sure absolutely no one has the faintest idea, but I'm wondering what's going to happen with Space Force if they're going to peel it away to a completely separate division, or they're going to basically absorb it back into the Air Force.
The latest I've read is they're just going to leave it alone for now. It's not worth their trouble. They have too many other fish to fry to worry about undoing that problem. I think it's going to hold. All they did was change the name. It was going to be called the Space Corps. That's what it was going to be called, 10 years ago when they were talking about this. And all they did was just change the name from Corps to Space Force, and to Space Force instead of Space Corps. They had plans of doing something like this, and they, you know, it just became political, I think, to some extent. But I think they're going to leave it alone, but we'll see.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, other than branding and having a logo and a design for uniforms that haven't been produced, I think it's ultimately just another division within the Air Force that just got a fancy name, and that's, I think, where it's going to stay. Because they had to do a whole bunch of other stuff to really kind of pull it out from the Air Force and make it its own proper division. So I think it'll just melt back into the Air Force. And the only remembrance will be their logos and their little flags.
Okay. There is a group called Space Command, unrelated. Space Command is located in Colorado. It, you know, it was around in the 80s, and then they backed off on it, and that's been brought back from the dead, you know, Space Command. Now they wanted to open it up in Huntsville, Alabama, or, you know, the Redstone facility. Redstone is where they built the original Redstone rockets for the early Mercury flights. So, you know, Huntsville is a big space area. So that's the one that's going to be political. I think that's going to, right now it's scheduled to switch to Huntsville. I think that's going to wind up bouncing right back to Colorado. We'll see. I'll let you know when I come across it, or maybe it'll be in the news. Very, very small part of the news. Thank you. WSUN.
Very good. Just out of curiosity, I've been keeping an eye open to see if anyone was going to be named as the guy running NASA. I haven't heard a peep of anyone. Have you heard even rumors out there?
I know of five women that they were talking about. I don't know of any guys. But, you know, I know they haven't picked anybody yet. One of the women is an ex-astronaut. Another one works for, is in charge of Smithsonian. I forgot what the other ones are, but there's five of them that I was thinking about. So maybe one of them.
Okay, very good. We'll see what develops. You know, ultimately, I think it's mostly dependent on Congress, how generous they are with the federal purse. But we'll see what happens. I'm hoping for the new projects and new results and all kinds of great stories to tell on future Sunday nights.
Okay, very good. Well, the money hasn't really been allocated for the Artemis program, and that was supposed to be an extra, like, $4 billion a year, and they never really got 10 cents. They have been getting their regular allocation year after year, and, you know, plus a slight increase, but nowhere near the money they needed to go to the moon. So I think, I remember we talked about it on the net many times. It was originally going to be 2028, and all of a sudden they pushed it to 2024. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes back to 2028. Maybe they'll split the difference to 2026. I hope something like that happens. Back to you, Roy. I'll stand by. WS2N.
Okay, very good, Paul. Before I move on with any more stories, if anyone else has any topics or questions or answers or statements or what have you of a scientific nature, if you're so inclined, hit that push to talk button. Okay, very well. On to the next story. And this might spark some conversation. It's about a subject that has been mentioned before on the TechNet. Apple may have struggled to get its AirPower multi-device charging pad to work, but just over the horizon is a new technology that supposedly promises to make wireless charging truly wireless. The Xiaomi is the latest company to promise a world without charging cables. We just don't know when it will actually arrive. Wireless charging in its current form is definitely convenient since it allows you to just plop a device like a smartphone or a headphone down on a pad to top off its battery without having to reach for the cable. But at the same time, it's also restrictive, requiring you to all but abandon a device on a desk or a side table until it's charged. Truly wireless charging is the ideal solution because as long as you're in the same room as the wireless power transmitter, your phone will charge no matter where it is, even if you're still using it in your hand. It sounds like total science fiction, but the technology exists, this article says. And back in 2016, a company called Osea demonstrated working prototypes of its Coda wireless charging system at CES. A smartphone upgraded with a special case could be carried anywhere around the company's booth and it would continue to charge indefinitely. Today, actually it was Friday, I believe, Xiaomi announced its own wireless charging ecosystem called the My Air Charge technology that appears to offer similar functionality and limitations as Osea's Coda technology. Let me drop for a sec. In lieu of wires or a pair of aligned magnetic coils, My Air Charge uses a transmitter about the size of a portable air conditioner. So how would you like to have that in your living room? Packed with antennas that both accurately determine the location of a device and then use beamforming to broadcast a millimeter-wide wave towards it. A separate, smaller collection of antennas function as a receiver inside another device, converting the wireless signals into about 5 watts of power, which is what the iPhone's tiny cube charger delivers when plugged into a power outlet. Xiaomi promises the system can provide power to multiple devices all at the same time, be it a smartphone, a tablet, headphones, or even a pair of wirelessly powered batteries like Osea also demonstrated a few years ago that ensured legacy devices never need a fresh pair. Distances are still limited to several meters or roughly the size of an average room, but the technology isn't hindered by physical obstacles, so the beefy power transmitter can potentially be hidden away out of sight where you would put a small portable air conditioner. It's exciting to see more companies announce wireless charging solutions, the article says, like this, because it helps legitimize the technology. But unfortunately, to date, all we have really are announcements. Since its debut in Consumer Electronics Show of 2016, Osea still hasn't launched a wireless charging product available to consumers, and Xiaomi's new announcement doesn't even include vague promises about how long it will take to get the company to make its My Air Charge technology available outside of its own R&D labs. So take it with a grain of salt. Matter of fact, I've also included a delightful little YouTube of an electrical engineer who takes apart the technology and explains why you should not hold your breath. But anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
KC2SHO.
Yes, John, welcome aboard. Glad to hear that the IRLP is working right.
Yes, good evening, Roy. I was wondering, does this double as a personal heater? In other words, could you maybe reduce your thermostat a little bit while this thing is on due to the RF heating effects on the human body? AC2GS, KC2SHO.
I would assume that there are a lot of unmentioned features of such a device. The electrical engineer who kind of discusses the underlying concept thinks that in order for them to approach 5 watts of RF getting into that device, capacitor, they would probably have to use up 50 watts. 500 watts. So you got a half of a kilowatt RF generator. So that room is going to be nice and roasty toasty. Not to mention your eyeballs will probably fry.
Yeah, I'm very curious about that getting approved for use anywhere, especially with the effects on the eyeball. Yeah, real interesting. It did make me think of one other thing, and that was when this whole pandemic started, I was researching UV sterilizers, and I saw that there were UV sterilizers that have a 360-degree radiation, but when they detect human presence, they would turn off radiation in that direction. Kind of interesting, something you could plop in a room, but unfortunately with a phone, you usually have it on you or near you, so directing the energy away from humans would be not beneficial to a charging station. I'll leave you with that. I'll let you finish your help, but yeah, real interesting. AC2GS, KC2SHL.
Yeah, I would assume their PR guy would talk about the beam-forming technology, that it narrows the beam so that the amount of RF outside of the range of the actual charging device would be minimal. But the number of antennas that were demonstrated in the model are not really that great as far as beam-forming a very, very narrow beam. The beam would probably be something semi-ridiculous, like I think they said something like 60 degrees. So that's all over the place. So, yeah, I have my doubts about this entire technology. It doesn't seem to be efficient. It's wasteful of energy. It's probably dangerous. And I don't know of anyone who would like a portable air conditioner sitting in the middle of a room someplace. Because I imagine you can't just kind of shove it up against the wall. You know, I might be wrong. I don't know. The antennas don't seem to be placed all over the place, so there must be blind spots. But, you know, it's one of those things that makes for a nice story, and news stations can play a two-minute blurb of it and amuse themselves, but I don't think it's practical. But we'll see.
Yeah, I thought I was done, but I guess you gave me a couple more ideas. One is, have you seen the pared-down videos of the, I forget the name of the product now, but the Elon Musk satellite system where they have the beam-forming dish? Real interesting. I'm sure you're on top of these things. You've probably seen it. That's pretty neat. It makes me think of similar kind of technology. Also, you know, this is something that's going to trip a lot of breakers. You can't just plug this in your living room and then run your, or, you know, plug it in somewhere and then also run some other piece of equipment in the room. 500 watts is going to be a big load for a home or business, you know, 15 or 20 amp circuit. Probably uses the current of an air conditioner and needs its own outlet installed. Yeah, there's a lot of barriers to making that work. You know, unfortunately, inverse square law is probably the biggest one. All right, I'm going to wrap it up. EC2GS, I got to load the fire and deal with the family here. You have a good night. I'll be listening, though.
Okay, John, glad to talk to you. Be well, and hopefully we'll talk again real soon. Yeah, this is a flash type of a thing. I sort of understand why people would like it. Because the concept is you don't have to put it down, you don't have to stick a wire in it, it just follows you through the air. So, you know, sounds interesting, probably never going to see anything like it. You know, invest in wire connectors, and the little Qi chargers work very nicely. You put it right next to the charger, and it has a very high efficiency. So keep that in mind, people. So I'll let it drop for a second, then I'll go on to my next fascinating story about lasers. Okay. In the 1950s, when physicists were racing to invent the first laser, they found that the rules of quantum mechanics restricted how pure the color of their light could be. Since then, physicists and engineers have always built lasers with these restrictions in mind. But new theoretical research from two independent groups of physicists indicates that nature is a little bit more lax than previously thought. The findings could lead to an improved, more monochromatic laser for applications such as quantum computing, which the researchers illustrate in two proposed laser designs. The work overthrows 60 years of understanding about what limits lasers, said